We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Focus. This is Carol Spindell, your guest host for today. This program was produced by Harriet Williamson, and at the controls, we have Jason Croft. Our guest in this segment of Focus is Judith Carney, and she is one of the co-authors, along with Richard Rosimoff, of In the Shadow of Slavery, Africa's Botanical Legacy in the Atlantic World. Judy Carney is a professor of geography at UCLA. She is also the author of the award-winning Black Rice, The African Origins of Rice Cultivation in the Americas, a book about how the farming expertise of African slaves was essential to the establishment of rice cultivation in the New World. The new book she has written with Richard Rosimoff is about the way slaves who were forcibly transported from Africa to the Americas brought with them their own food crops and the knowledge of how to grow them. If we learn about these foods, she says, they tell a remarkable story of exile, survival, endurance, and memory. As we talk, listeners are welcome to call in and join our conversation with comments or questions. The numbers are 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. You can also email a question or comment at will-talk@illinois.edu. Judy, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to speak with you today and your audience.
I want to start by asking you about this word we hear a lot these days from scholars and food writers, foodway. Could you start by telling us what is meant by a foodway?
That is a very interesting question because I've had to unpack it a bit in my work. Foodway kind of refers to a meeting of different types of foods that are associated with the presence of people or a culture or an ethnic group in a particular area. So a foodway develops from the presence of people, whether it is, say, Italians coming to parts of the United States and influencing the food there, or Greeks in other places. And what I'm trying to do when I use that word in the book is to get across that people and cultures migrate and that they have foods that are important to them, that they reassert those foods and the cultivation of them with migration. And, of course, in this case, the migration was forced, that of enslaved Africans to the Americas.
So the idea of a foodway helps to explain why places as far apart as West Africa, Brazil, and the southern United States might all eat black-eyed peas on special occasions.
Correct, correct. And also a foodway distinguishes, I played around with the idea a lot because if I call it a cuisine, it suggests a more higher cultural thing that, is for people with money to purchase. But a foodway is something more earthy and kinetic. It's connected to people who maybe not even under very easy circumstances have foods from wherever they arrived from mm-hmm. that are important to them.
Now, you say that your book is written in part as a refutation or a riposte, maybe, to the idea of the Columbian Exchange. So before we talk about how you disagree with that idea, perhaps you could explain to us what is meant by the Columbian Exchange.
Yeah, this is actually a very wonderful concept that historian Alfred Crosby came up with about 20 years ago. And the concept is that we can begin to understand the process of European expansion throughout the world by looking at the plants, the animals, and even the microbes that traveled with them. And it was a very important way for many scholars to understand this dynamic movement of plants in global history. For instance, plants of the Americas, such as maize or corn, as we call it in the United States, manioc, peanut, which is also from South America, tomato, avocado, the movement of these plants across geographical space is connected, as Crosby mentioned, with the overseas maritime expansion of Europeans from basically the 15th century to the 18th century. And so that is the Columbian Exchange, the idea of it, of the significant transformation of environments in different parts of the world that occurred as a result of the movement of plants, animals, and microbes across geographic space.
And I get the feeling, reading your book, that you want to say, wait a minute, that's not the whole story. There's another part of the story about plants coming from Africa that hasn't been told.
That's correct. And it's interesting because now, fortunately, on many decades of research, I think an average person might know the origin of some of the plants from the Americas or some of the plants from Asia. But there's not very much known about plants that arrived and are originated in Africa. And in part, I believe that the lack of knowledge is because many people, the popular perception of Africa is as a continent that can't feed itself. And one of the points I tried to make in this book is that this has not always been the case. It's more modern aspect of how we see Africa, but certainly in previous centuries there was food movements coming from Africa, and my point is that many of those foods, trying to identify them for an audience before I then go on to discuss which ones are of African origin.
Well, it's true that when we hear about Africa and food, we generally hear about food shortages. And I think there is a popular perception of Africa as a place that doesn't produce enough food to feed its population, that lacks the technical knowledge to produce more food. And maybe even the idea is out there that Africa produces food of poor nutritional quality.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you'd agree?
That's true. And yet, it historically had a number of cereal crops that are important in the world today, sorghum and millet, widely consumed across the tropical and subtropical parts of the world, and those are of African origin. And in the first book, my mention was of the native rice species to Africa, which was one of the first to come to the Americas because rice is an introduced cereal or grain. And then also that coffee comes from Africa, okra, you mentioned earlier, black-eyed peas, there's pigeon peas if you're in more tropical parts of the Americas, there's yam that comes from Africa, very important. And there were many food crops that were from Asia, but some of the root crops, such as banana and plantain, they were established in Africa thousands of years before Europeans got there and were already important parts of the food systems of Africa. So part of unpacking the idea of the Columbian Exchange is to bring relief and attention to the African components that have been ignored, not consciously, but because the perception of Africa has been such that we don't think of it having any foods of good quality or any foods that are significant in terms of global food history.
Well, I had the good fortune, I have to say, to grow up with grandparents who had a 5-acre truck farm in Arkansas and grew almost everything they ate. And when we sat down to Sunday dinner at their home, which of course meant Sunday lunch, the table groaned. And it certainly never occurred to me that this was a meal that owed anything to Africa. I thought of fried chicken and collard greens and coffee with sorghum molasses in it. I thought of all those things as Southern cooking.
Very interesting. I didn't know you had. That's interesting. You had sorghum molasses as well. Yeah. No, that's what we come back now to, that idea of food weight, which is embraces yet another, a second component that we're getting to now, is with your description of the table groaning with the food. Many of these crops are of African origin, but they're combined in new ways with other crops that are of New World or, you know, Amerindian origin. So part of the food way of former plantation societies is a sort of fusion means of preparing meals where you will have some things that are from Africa combined with some things that are from Europe and others that are actually owe their origin to Native Americans in the New World. And what makes this interesting is, and in a sense, I also want to mention that I think this is what has also occluded our ability to see the African components, because they come into these fusion cuisines, or as they're known today, but fusion foodways, and they're mixed with other things. But we forget that it was these foods were, one, we don't know which ones were African. That's the first thing I tried to do. And secondly, that much of the cooking in former plantation societies was done by enslaved women. So they are bringing these foods that have significance from their own heritage and their own cultures that have remained in their food plots into new ways and combining them, and they sort of stealthily make their way onto the plantation tables and become established as part of these regional now culinary signatures of former plantation societies.
Well, the dispersion of plants and animals happened because of the transatlantic slave trade. We know that, and we're going to get to that more. But what about Islam? Islam also played a role in the dispersion of foods, but how was that? How did that work?
Yeah, well, that's actually gotten a fair amount of attention in terms of academic research from the expansion of Islam and also the influence of Islam in the Muslim period of Iberia. And this brought sugarcane into the awareness of Europeans. Sugarcane comes from Southeast Asia. It brought a number of, it probably played a role in contributing to some of the crops in East Africa going into Asian, Indian Ocean trading networks, which are very ancient and existed long before the role of Islam in the region and the development of Islam. And the food trade that then, because this was such a broadly based religion, geographically its expansion was quick and went over a great distance from basically the Mediterranean all the way to Asia and Southeast Asia. And there was a lot of food introduced and moved around. So in a sense, it's kind of, in its own way, a precursor to what the Columbian Exchange, as I explained it earlier, which is based on European movement of plants and animals. There's a very earlier one based on Islam, and even prior to that, going back to the Greeks and perhaps even earlier, movements of people and plants and animals through the Indian Ocean networks.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you go back to these earlier eras in Africa and look at African food production, you point out that the earliest African food producers were probably mobile herders, and that cattle may have been domesticated in the Sahara. Is it 8,000 years ago?
Actually, now they're... there's been some very recent genetics work done on looking at mtDNA, and it's almost certain that cattle were independently domesticated in northeastern, in the Horn of Africa area. About almost 11,000 years ago, we think that the date will come out to be, but the evidence now is suggesting an independent domestication of cattle from wild cattle populations in that area of Africa. When I was in graduate school, all we heard about was the domestication of cattle in the Near East. But it does seem that Africa is a secondary, not a secondary center, but an independent center of domestication.
And there are specific breeds of African cattle, are there not?
There are. There's three different ones. I don't know if you've ever seen the Koori cattle, the ones that are in Lake Chad with these humongous horns that branch out. They're really beautiful. And it's also found in Uganda. That I think the president has his own herd of them. And then there's another type of cattle that is the Ndama. It's a very short cattle breed, stocky, but you find that a lot in West Africa. And its great advantage is that it is not susceptible to the tsetse fly, which bears a trypanosome and can give the cattle, it's, in other words, it's kind of less resistant. It's more resistant, to trypanosomiasis, sleeping sickness. So that's its great advantage. You can graze it and raise it in areas where other cattle would die. And then I should just mention that another area of domestication is the Indian cattle with the humped zebu cattle, which is separate from this African humpless cattle breeds that were developed in this period of time.
And then what about donkeys and guinea fowl? You also mentioned those. Those are, I know donkeys at least seem to be such an important domesticated animal all over so many areas.
Yeah, and they early went out. I mean, even the Old Testament and the Bible have references to donkeys. Donkeys left Africa at an early date, but they are indisputably domesticated in Africa. And the guinea fowl was made a very early appearance on slave ships in multiple places in the Americas, in plantation and mining societies. It was a small food animal that was transported and used aboard slave ships to feed the crew, but also brought to places like Haiti and Santo Domingo at an Dominican Republic at an early period, along with Brazil. It was actually drawn in one of the natural histories of Brazil that was done by a scientific expedition in the early 1600s. So this was a very, even though we don't think of the guinea fowl in this way, it was
it's not so well known here. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very important food animal in tropical America.
They say armies move on their stomachs, and I realized while reading this book that the institution of transatlantic slavery, like a military campaign, had to be provisioned. This was a new way of thinking about this terrible institution.
Yeah, I think that was that was really the impetus for writing this book, because much has been written on slavery, about the commodities that were produced, about the unfortunate trafficking of people and treatment of them as human commodities, the forced migration, the plantation societies, but always it was a really kind of a marginal area to explore what were actually the foods that were keeping this institution that went on for almost 400 years. What were the foods that were important in keeping this institution going and shifting the discussion from commodities to subsistence, to the very foods that sustained this bringing of a settlement of more than probably 11 million that we can document people to the Americas? What was involved in that whole historical unfolding, that tragedy? What was involved, and what did those foods mean to the people who were swept up into it and brought to different parts of the Americas? That was my idea that I wanted to pursue and interrogate.
Uh-huh. And this is one of the really fascinating parts of this book when you read it, because going into these logistics, this is not something that we have often thought about. Now, before we go into that, I do want to just tell listeners, if you've recently joined us, you're listening to Focus on WILL AM 580, and I'm the guest host today, Carol Spindell. We're talking with guest Judith Carney, and she is the co-author of a book called In the Shadow of Slavery, Africa's Botanical Legacy in the Atlantic World. And you're welcome to join our conversation. Call us at 333-9455 or at 1-800-222-9455 or send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Okay, so to go back, we forget that so many of the immigrants to the Americas came not through choice. They were forcibly transported here. They were African. And how did this all take place? At the same time that settlements were springing up along the West African coast, the labor force was being captured and sold out of the interior. And when you think about these two things happening simultaneously, this could have caused a crisis in subsistence and a famine. In fact, this seems like a recipe for disaster and famine. Is that what happened?
In some places it did. The internecine struggles, the marauding armies armed with weapons from European traders who were interested in exchanging them for captives, Africans, it caused chaos in many areas. But it was principally the peoples that were swept up into the slave trade were those from the interior, as you mentioned. And it disrupted their food systems and caused chaos. And every now and then there were famines. Philip Curtin's work has brought attention to that in these areas, because some of the areas, such as in the Sahel, the area south of the Sahara, which is a little vulnerable climatically to oscillations and rainfall, et cetera, that would be enough, the political chaos, to cause famine. But mostly, and what I found of great interest was to ask the question, as these people are being brought to the coast and enslaved and awaiting the arrival of European slave ships that were happy to predate them, the captains, what was going on with food? And from what we can gather, food supplies were being reorganized along the littoral, the coast of Western Africa, and estates of food production were taking place. Most slave ships ideally tried to make it to the West African coast between the months of November and May, when there is less likelihood of rain, squalls, and also the malaria factor and other disease factor in the dry season is diminished. And so while some ships, with this was the general course, but it wasn't always the case. So people were put, who were brought from the interior, if it was outside the typical period of enslavement with the ships arriving, it was during the rainy season, and they were put to work to grow food crops that would ultimately be used as provisions on the slave ships. Also in these societies, not everywhere, but the slave trade selected for men over women generally, but not always, depends on which part of Africa, but that also left women more involved in food production in Africa than men in many areas, which we see some gender dimensions of women in food production even to this day, dominating food production in many parts of West Africa. And then also, as these armies are and elites are reorganizing polities, peoples, and who's winning and who's losing in these various chaotic struggles that were going on around weaponry being available and groups being favored by Europeans, there were also a form of adaptation developed in which some people in villages would remain in sort of a tributary relationship to a predatory military group of others, and they would then be charged with producing a certain amount of food, a surplus that would feed those military.
Now, some people were so successful at continuing to produce food that you describe caravans coming to the coast from the interior, and they not only brought slaves to sell, but they were also bringing foodstuffs, which they were selling to provision the slave ships.
Yeah. And they're also, of course, carrying the food that they would be eating en route as well down to the coast.
Even though slaves were not fed particularly well, the captains were buying enormous amounts of grain and animals to provision these ships, were they not?
Yes, and isn't that astounding when one thinks about our contemporary views and images of Africa and the bleeding of so many millions of people into the transatlantic slave trade? We think there were at least 30,000. We can document, David Eltis and his colleagues have documented on the transatlantic slave trade database, at least 35,000 voyages that were made carrying human beings to the Americas. You think about many of those voyages took 3 weeks if you were lucky, sometimes a couple of months. And even if people weren't fed well, that's an enormous demand on food. And most of that food was not coming from Europe. It was coming from West Africa, or Western Africa, I should say, to express the area all the way from Senegal down to Angola.
Well, they didn't have a lot of ways to preserve food in that era either. And you describe how animals were suspended in cages. Both sides of the ship were lined with animals that would be slaughtered during the voyage.
Yeah, they kept it the way you kept animals in those days. The refrigeration of those days was to keep the animal alive until you were ready to kill it for food, for a meal. So they that's the real significance of the so-called African chicken, the guinea fowl, was to bring those on board. They were easily raised and kept, and also we see that there were other food animals brought, and I call them food animals, to get across the sense that these are live animals being boarded on these ships. And sometimes cows for milk, but also other animals such as sheep and probably pigs, although I haven't been able to find a lot of information on this. I did my best in terms of combing the records. But a lot of animals that were moved in this way across on ships.
I know our listeners can't see the illustrations in the book. They'll have to go to the library or the bookstore to check these out. But it is really remarkable to see the image of women slaves around a fire on the slave ship with their mortars and pestles and spoons cooking. And I just hadn't really thought about that.
Yeah, there's not a lot written on this dimension of the, and I think that another generation of scholars who will work in archives with a sensitivity towards looking at what is being said about food and various ship captains' diaries, et cetera, more will come to light with time. But it is interesting that when you mentioned seeing the women with the mortar and pestle, women were separated from men on these slave ships. And what the presence of the African way of milling grains by hand within a hollowed-out mortar and handheld pestles, the significance of that is that it meant that the grains were purchased by the slave ship captain unhusked in their hulls. And that means that anything that could technically, any grain in that manner that could technically be left on board the slave ship at its conclusion could in fact serve as seed rice for anybody who wanted to reinstigate or pioneer the cultivation of a particular dietary preference.
So you think that there must have been rice left, perhaps, from some voyages. That rice found its way somehow into the gardens that slaves had, dooryard gardens and so on, in the New World.
Yes, and because there are, I mean, it's interpolation between independent little observations and events, but we know that a Portuguese slave ship arrived in Charleston, South Carolina, for instance. This is one example, in the late 17th century. And on that slave ship, The colonists, the description in the historical record reads that the colonists in South Carolina were very happy to see that there was rice that they could plant from that arrival of that slave ship. Well, what's interesting here is that in these slave-based societies, planters themselves, even though they're called planters, the slaveholders, they were like business people. They managed this this plantation, but they weren't out there actually putting the grains in the ground and doing the actual work of planting. And my work in other parts of the Americas, historically as well as field work that I have done, shows that actually in many areas that I have been able to research, that most of the food crops were grown by the enslaved. They weren't grown by the slaveholder or the planter. So what I think is going on is that the people themselves for whom those crops, if you were to think about it just from the point of view of Asian cuisine, and Asians migrated but they didn't have rice, a similar thing is going on with West Africans where they're scaffolding and building entire meals around rice. They're now landed as slaves in various parts of the Americas. And in certain areas that were topographically and environmentally, climatically suitable for the cultivation of rice, the very people who, for whom that was a dietary staple, if they can access the seeds, were growing their own food, could then plant it. And in many cases, planters themselves discovered new crops in the food fields of slaves. They didn't have words in their own languages for some of these crops. That's how the word yam, for instance, comes into English. It's the West African word to eat in many West African languages. And okra, that's another West African word. Gumbo, the meal based with also with okra, is another West African word. So, and banana is yet another word that comes. And so what I try to show is the very appropriation of these words is one way of seeing the unfamiliarity of the plantation owner with many of these crops that have arrived with people. But the plantation owner, unlike the captain of the slave ship, was not in West Africa. He is in the Americas. The knowledge that the slave ship captain might have had in terms of boarding and loading and stocking these foodstuffs was simply to transact the movement of the slave ship across the Atlantic and trying to ensure the survival of as many people as possible, not from a sense of kindness, but rather from a sense of commerce. And so once the people themselves are disembarked and the slave ship captain it leaves the port in the New World and generally returns back to the home country, either in North America or Europe. So it was trying to, what I was trying to do was sort of show the steps, the geography of how these crops are sort of in the background of this immense commerce that's unfolding, and to bring those out, tease them out, and to show how something that was perhaps insignificant to a slaveholder might be what would make one stay healthy or survive in your own food field if you were able to plant that as an enslaved person.
Well, you know, when I imagine slaves working on a plantation in America, I try to picture that historical reality, and not knowing very much about the realities of what they ate, what kind of foods they were given. Your book points out in many places they had to not only work on the plantation in the commodity fields for the planter, but they also had to grow their own food in what little free time they had. They were either given very meager amounts of food or simply given a little time off and a little bit of land, and they had to fend for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think what's interesting there, and this is again why having had the wonderful opportunity in my life to be able to work in so many places, Mexico, Brazil, many other areas of the Americas, as well as West Africa, is not only does one start to see the significance of food for people, but also to sort of see that you what was Europeans, and let us now shift our discussion to the tropical America, the Caribbean, northeast Brazil, northeastern South America, the Guianas, et cetera. Europeans arrived, and they had apprenticed, even Columbus apprenticed with his father-in-law, about how to grow sugar on the island of Madeira before he came to the Americas. It was not something, it's a root crop. You have to learn how to do it and transfer it and everything. And, of course, the Iberians, people from Portugal and Spain, learned it from the Muslims who, coming back again to this earlier exchange of crops that went through the Mediterranean, out to the Atlantic Islands and across the Atlantic to tropical America. Europeans may have apprenticed and known how to do that and set up sugar plantations, but one thing they did not know how to do was to grow food in the tropics. And it's radically different than growing food in the way we think of growing food in North America, where you have strong seasonality and you have a winter of one sort or another that kills off the plant pests, and then you resume your cultivation the following year. In the tropics, you can plant things year-round. And what people have devised, whether we talk about the Old World tropics, including Africans, or New World tropics with Amerindians, they've devised very clever ways to plant, not so much in a monoculture with just a single stand of something or another, but to have very biodiverse plots of many different cultivars growing together in what looks like a riot of vegetation, but is actually done it deliberately in that way to ward off insects and all kinds of other predators that build up because there's nothing really to kill them off because they have year-round high temperatures and humidity. So the significance is that many of these enslaved people in tropical America were brought, and the Europeans themselves were totally dependent on imported food from their own countries. They didn't know how to produce food in the tropics, and oftentimes they left it to the enslaved to do so themselves.
So this idea of bringing this expertise with them, when they were brought against their will to these places, they had this farming know-how, they had this technical knowledge, and you're saying that that was a really key thing that they brought, as well as perhaps being able to bring with them a few seeds somehow that were left over on the slave ship or that somehow got there in this, they had no baggage, they couldn't pack
right.
it up, but somehow a few things managed to come along.
Right.
And they had the expertise to make use of those.
Yes.
Now, you tell that beautiful story about, I believe it's an Akan folktale. So in a way, this knowledge of what happened has come down to us through African oral literature about the girl with the rice in her hair.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting because a number of, and now we shift to different, I'm a geographer, but anthropologists who have done wonderful work in various parts of the world in about cultural history have contributed to this as well. So one thing that struck me, and this is a story that I heard in Suriname from people descended from Maroons, from fugitive escaped slave communities. If people could escape, they did usually. But if you had a rainforest, it was easier to do so than if you didn't. And so there were large Maroon communities in the Guianas, the former Guianas, and in across this whole area from Suriname to sort of sub-Amazonic Brazil, south of the Amazon estuary into Maranhão. I heard, and none of these people, they're all descended from either fugitive slave communities, and they're called various names in different cultures, but they're Maroons and just used broad name. And their descendants today, among many of them, they actually grow rice when they can. And this struck me as very interesting. So I asked a group first when I was doing research in Brazil, why is it that you grow rice? Because I knew full well that there are two domesticated species of rice in the world, one from Asia and one from West Africa. And why was it that people who escaped slavery were able to grow this crop and what did it mean to them? And they told me, and I heard variations of this in this very disparate remote locales where I talked to people, that they said that a woman who got off, who was enslaved and came off of a slave ship gave them rice. So what they're doing is they're pinpointing first a woman and secondly a slave ship as the conveyor of the person and rice to the Americas. And in the story, they talk about how she tucked grains of rice in her hair as she got off the slave ship. And then when she was able to flee plantation society and join fugitive maroon groups, she again tucked grains of rice in her hair and brought them to her. And this, they say, is how they began the cultivation of rice. I found it very interesting because, again, I heard it in Brazil. There's a similar story in French Guiana that has been recorded, and yet another variation of it in Suriname and maybe elsewhere, but those are the areas that I've read about or done some work in. And it is an oral history that has been part of their tradition for hundreds of years is pinpointing slave ship, a female, and rice in many parts of West Africa is a woman's crop, which is also interesting. But it also comes back to what we were talking about earlier on the slave ship, how women were separated from men, and women were often put to work in food the processing of unhusked rice or other grains to hand mill it with a mortar and pestle, and also in the preparation of the meals and the gruel that was typically fed to the enslaved aboard the slave ship. Because they were separated, they were located near the kitchen or the galley, which was placed on the quarterdeck of the slave ship, and also near some of the kitchen stores. So this, what would sound like it's a legend or a sort of oral history that's kind of interesting, actually has a kind of grounding in a very possible event that would have been one means of transmission of bringing the grain to the Maroons. And unlike people who were actually enslaved on the plantations, anybody who escaped, if they could escape with foods that they'd like to grow but might take more work, they could do so. So rice could flourish under those conditions. They could cultivate rice, whereas if you worked in sugar, in brutal toil and sugar, especially at the time of harvest, it was all you could do to just have root crops like yams and sweet potatoes, and manioc was not as popular simply because manioc, in order to eat it, that's cassava for other people who may not know the word, you have to spend a lot of time taking out the cyanides that are actually in the root and expressing that in order to consume it. So we have a situation here where on the sugar plantations, food plots of slaves typically had a lot of root and tuber crops because you plant them, you leave them in the ground, they're low maintenance, they continuously produce like a lot of these tropical foods do, continuously produce, and you're not timed to like having to harvest them and then figure out where you're going to store them for a long period of time, again in the tropics. So looking at the Maroons' stories and what they actually cultivated and selected for as their free agents of what they're going to eat now is kind of gives us a window on seeing how certain of the African foods and preferences, dietary preferences, get reestablished in the Americas. And that was my point in bringing up that story, that narrative.
Well, you call these things memory dishes, that they're survival foods, and you talk about greens. You know, in West Africa, all kind of edible leaves are eaten.
Yeah.
And in the southern U.S., we eat mustard greens and collards. We love that stuff so much, which came from Africa. And then you also talk about the bitter taste that's somehow part of African cuisine and is carried over. I found that interesting. Do other cuisines have a bitter appreciation for the bitter Or is that very African?
I don't know. You know, maybe some of your listeners do. It's so characteristic of flavor. And you know what's so interesting, although nobody in these days spoke like we do of micronutrients and minerals and vitamins, these are loaded with, you know, vitamin K, helps with bone growth. It's just like this is where you got your vitamins, through greens. So the greens are really an inflection that's coming across and being reestablished with actually some new crops, or like some crops that were like some of the vegetable amaranthus plants are pantropical. So Africans coming to the Americas could have even recognized the potential of some of these foods in areas that they could consume, that were safe to consume. So what is really fascinating is, without knowing the language that we can refer to things by vitamins and minerals today, the diets are showing a sort of inflection of having greens as a really important component, and it would have been loaded with vitamins and minerals that are critical for human well-being.
Well, and even that fried chicken that we served with the greens, you point out that has a connection to Africa, that deep frying and fritters were really common in African food and still are.
Yeah, they are. You go to Brazil and the Bahian cuisine, it's a street cuisine with the women cooking all kinds of fritters out there on the streets. And that deep frying in Africa, oftentimes in palm oil, if you're in the tropical part of Africa, is a very significant way that food is prepared in many areas of tropical West Africa. And it also is recombined and with even use of new kinds of ingredients that were brought, indigenous to the Americas. And I think also that looking at how a dish like gumbo or some of these stew dishes, these one-pot dishes were put together, also is a significant way that food is prepared in West Africa that we saw recombined with including new ingredients in the Americas.
Well, there are also drinks. I mean, we all grew up with Coca-Cola and of course, coffee. None of us is giving up our coffee. But you talk about other kind of drinks like made from tamarind and hibiscus. I think these might be ingredients in some other soft drinks as well that are so much part of our cuisine and that we don't think of as African.
Yeah. I mean, gum arabic, which comes from West Africa and the Sahelian region, that is actually an important ingredient in a lot of foods. So some of the African crops that are used in beverages are kind of invisible to the modern audience, like tamarind and Worcestershire sauce. And tamarind is of West African, not Indian, even though it's South Asian is a very important crop there as well. But tamarind is a very popular drink in Mexico, lowland Mexico, and Central America, tamarindo. And then Jamaica is the one that is made from hibiscus or sorrel. And it's kind of a tart cranberry taste for those of your audience who may not know it, and it's just absolutely delicious. So there's two drinks there that came across. But you mentioned Coca-Cola, and I try to refer to that as sort of the marriage of two tropical plants, one from the New World and one from Africa, because the cola nut is traded all over West Africa, and a sense of grace to bring a few cola nuts when you meet people in various parts of West Africa as a sense of well-intentioned person and sharing. But it was also used for water that was stagnant on slave ships. Slave ship captains learned, undoubtedly from the African people themselves, that if you put that cola nut into the water, it would sweeten and freshen the water, which almost sounds like an 18th century version of talking about a Coca-Cola drink advertisement to this day.
It does. What a strange combination of things to think about, a slave ship and water for bare survival in a terrible, desperate time, and Coca-Cola. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap it up and leave it there. There's so many more aspects to this story, and listeners can read the book for themselves, so many details that are interesting in it. In the Shadow of Slavery, Africa's Botanical Legacy in the Atlantic World. This is Carol Spindell. I've been your guest host today on Focus, and our guest today is Judith Carney from UCLA. Judy, thank you so much for being with us.
Very welcome. Lovely to speak with all of you.
I hope you've enjoyed the conversation today. Thanks very much for joining us, and stay tuned for the Afternoon Magazine.